This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the Fed's two-day policy meeting, as you know, kicking off today. It's the first of the new year, and we will hear from Jay Powell tomorrow in that press conference. Policymakers widely expected to raise rates by a quarter percentage point, slowing from December's 50 basis point increase after four straight 75 basis point moves. But the big question is, what words do they take out of that statement, and what comes after this move?
Well, to help us see into the crystal ball, look into the future. Very pleased to have back with us Dr. Stephen Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor at Keel Point. He's a former member of the U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member. He's based in Washington, D.C., joining us today from there via Zoom. Dr. Skanke, good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And it's great to be with you, Tim and Carol. It's always a fun time, and especially coming into this meeting today and tomorrow, there's so much good news for the Fed to be taking in. Their conversations are likely to be a whole lot different than they were 6 weeks or 12 weeks ago.
There is so much good news, but there's also some concerning news that could lead to potentially rates staying higher for longer. And I point specifically to the jobs market and what we see with just an incredibly resilient jobs market. It's really good, make no mistake, for Americans. It's not so good for the Federal Reserve because they're concerned about a wage price spiral.
Well, that's certainly on their list of concerns. We did get some good news just this morning with the employment cost index coming down again 1% for the fourth quarter, annualizes at 4%. Obviously, it's not where the Fed wants it to be, but it dropped from an annualized rate of 4.8 to 4%. We do expect that the employment gains number coming out on Friday will also be helpful, not negative, but down from where it was even just in December.
So I want to go right to what I think is or could be a really important issue. And if you think about it, and in one of our, I think it was maybe our one of our newsletters that was out this morning, I can't remember which one, but it talked about made in China inflation. And this speaks to our Bloomberg Big Take, which we'll get to a little bit later on. But back in September of 2016, then Fed Chair Janet Yellen mulled the Fed's first interest rate hike in almost a decade. China's economic and market wobbles were among the reasons she ended up staying her hand. How does China, Steve, complicate the situation for Jay?
Well, China is really come back online in far more quickly, I think, than anyone expected. They ended their COVID restraints. They're putting monetary and fiscal stimulus into it. They're standing behind their real estate sector, and so production in China will be helpful. Not that it's been a big negative for inflation, but it certainly will be helpful, and it will be what helps the global economy be less likely to fall into recession. Probably the problem or the biggest challenge for the Fed from China's increased activity is that it's going to be increasing its demand for energy, and that'll just put upward pressure on energy prices. And so that's been a positive for inflation coming down. That positive impact is going to go away.
Yeah, I was just looking through our story because I think, you know, concerns about Chinese inflation, essentially what it could do in terms of kicking up inflation and the drag on the global economy, I think it's something like a 1 percentage point difference. I mean, do we need to be worried that it is going to make ultimately the Fed say, you know what, we don't quite know how the China factor and its reopening, how much pickup and momentum we will see and how much drawdown on global commodities and pressure on those prices that they might just stay higher for longer?
Well, it certainly is going to be on their mind, and that certainly can be a factor in their decision to stay higher for longer. But in some respects, time is really on their side. The core PCE inflation deflator that came out last week, very good news for the Fed. It's annualized over the last 3 months at 2.9%. It's not at 2%, but it's come down significantly from where it was. The tightening and higher interest rates are slowing economic growth, the job vacancy gap, all that's a plus. So the Fed is, I think, likely to increase 25 basis points tomorrow. Most believe that it'll do another 25 basis points in mid-March. And before it has to do anything after that, it'll have a whole lot of information. And many believe the consensus of economists is that we'll continue to see inflation fall really back to where the Fed wants it to be, notwithstanding the negative influence that higher energy prices coming as a result of China coming back online so strongly could also have.
Okay, so that's a wild card at this point. That's something that we need to keep in mind. And remember, you know, oil supply is not something that the Fed can control. Oil demand, the Fed can control, I guess, to a certain extent when it comes to raising rates and tamping down demand. Dr. Skanky, I want to go back to your point about higher for longer. When do you think, how long do you think the Fed will keep rates this high?
I think they'll keep them this high at least through the end of June. Their rhetoric tomorrow is going to be very much on track with their higher for longer.
That's surprising to hear only to June, though, because in December, the Fed said they had no plans to cut this year.
Well, that's right. And this is part of their forward guidance. They're sounding very hawkish on purpose, notwithstanding what they're seeing internally with the slowing of the economy and some of the other achievements that are coming forth. But rather than having to raise interest rates further and push the economy either into a recession or deeper into a recession, they're trying to strip out some of the euphoria, enthusiasm, exuberance. They look at the S&P up 6% for the year. How is that not a frustration to them? Mm-hmm. And they're trying to use their rhetoric, their forward guidance, to tamp that out. But they're also looking at very much a weakening economy. And many now believe, many who thought that it certainly could just bounce around flat and then maybe tip into a recession in second or third quarter, are now seeing that perhaps even in the first quarter, we're going to end up with negative real economic growth.
So, you know, it's an interesting time. And Steve, yesterday we were talking with our Steve Matthews and our team about a story about how Fed is going to, you know, clash with Wall Street once again, because you've got traders expecting a peak policy rate of around 4.9% by May and June, falling to below 4.5% by the December meeting, further cuts indicated during 2024. However, the latest, you know, dot plot from the central bank forecast showed 17 of 19 officials projecting rates above 5% this year, two of them above 5.5%. That's a bit of a gap, a bit of a disconnect. Let's play the arbitrage there, but it's just interesting to see that gap. I mean, obviously the Fed's going to do what it's got to do, but who usually has it right? Are traders right about this?
That's a very good question. And to be honest, it's absolutely fascinating when you look at the dot plot. Mm-hmm. And you really have to ask yourself, do they believe what they're saying? Or is this part of the hawkish message they want to send to tamp out this enthusiasm? They're very frustrated with easing in financial markets. They're trying to wring out inflation, and financial markets, Wall Street, are acting as though that job is already finished. In the second half of the year, interest rates are going to decline, and we'll be back to the old game. It'll be the Fed pivot. The Fed absolutely does not want the market to believe that.
That's right. Reservations are up at the pivot bistro.
Right.
Investors are buying into it.
They are.
So what could Jay Powell say tomorrow? What could the Fed communicate tomorrow to really hammer home that this is not what they want to see?
Well, they are going to say they haven't seen anything that tells them they can stop raising interest rates. They're going to talk about higher ongoing increases, plural, in rates that will be required, and the rates will remain at higher levels for some time. He won't let anyone press him to say what that exactly means, but higher rates, higher levels for some time. Their hope, it really is amazing to watch it. Their hope is that at some point, markets will take a step back and stop this frenzy and belief that the pivot has already happened and that the Fed is happy where inflation is. It's not happy where inflation is, and it'll continue to operate until it gets it down.
Right.
But it's almost as though it doesn't matter so much anymore how much the Fed increases rates or how long they keep them at higher levels. Inflation seems to be in the process of being wrung out as the economy cools, the employment sector is working itself out, and it all gets back to some form of equilibrium.
Right.
The Fed doesn't want to get fooled about. They want to see it happen. So they're not going to trust that it'll happen on its own.
All right, we've got to run. Steve, good to check in with you. Be well. Dr. Steve Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor at Keel Point, former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member, joining us via Zoom from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Tim, remember how we were all on a buying spree during the pandemic?
Well, yeah, aren't you still waiting for your couch?
Just a few things. Well, the same goes for those in the shipping industry who were looking to invest record profits made during the pandemic. Container lines, man, they went on a buying binge.
Well, now all those new vessels will start arriving, and they've got to be named, just as the global economy is slowing. This story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands later this week, already online at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal. With more, we've got Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber and Bloomberg News trade czar Brendan Murray, who joins us on the phone in London. Joel's here in our Interactive Brokers studio. So Joel, how do you name a ship?
Well, you go to the Midwest and you sort of like throw a dart at a map, and sometimes it lands on a place called Mayview, Missouri. So, Brendan, why is Maersk, who makes a lot of big vessels, some of them bordering on 400 meters even, and these are the style of boat cargo vessels that Tim alluded to that are going to be hopefully coming to oceans near you and helping alleviate trade problems.
Not too many.
But why did Maersk, Copenhagen-based company, go to Mayview, Missouri to name one of its ships, which that name will be the Mayview Maersk?
That's right. So Maersk is a 120-year-old company, and they're very proud of their history. A guy named Arnold Peter Moeller married a woman whose family was from the tiny town of Mayview, Missouri. This was about 50 miles east of Kansas City. I tried to find a stoplight using Google Earth, and I couldn't find one. That's not to say it's the folks there aren't proud of it. And I'm told there's even a plaque commemorating the fact that they've got one of the world's biggest ships named after the town.
Okay, so names aside, and maybe we can spend a little bit more time with that yet. But Maersk isn't even the biggest buyer, right? Like, who are MSC is one name that's come up in some Bloomberg Business Week stories lately. It also happens to be a big buyer of ships.
That's right. So this industry, the container shipping industry, made record profits over the past 2 years, basically because we all bought things for our backyards or our home offices. Now that is starting to cool off. But in the meantime, they've all it's dominated by about 10 companies, half in Europe, half in Asia. And MSC, as you mentioned, is the biggest one. It's a sort of fairly low-key company based in Switzerland, owned by an Italian billionaire. And they are going full. They're putting all their cards in the ocean freight game. They have something like 130 ships on order now at about $150 to $200 million per ship. Somebody do the math for me on that, but it's $20-30 billion worth of ships they have on order. So yeah, but Maersk on the other hand is wants to be more of a door to door kind of end to end logistics provider. So they only have, you know, a couple dozen ships on order compared to probably 10 times the amount that or 10 times more that MSC has.
I got to say, I keep thinking of a conversation Tim and I had recently with Mario Cordero, executive director at the Port of Long Beach, who talked about shipping containers being canceled. You know, very different from what we saw in the pandemic. There's no backup. Prices are coming down. It's a very different environment. Are these guys, did they make some wrong bets?
Well, they don't bet on, you know, a couple $100 million on a container ship on what's happening over the next 12 to 18 months. These are investments of, you know, 20, 30, 40 years sometimes. But this is a very cyclical business. It rises and falls with the economic tides. And we are, you know, the economy, the global economy is softening. And all these ships are going to hit the market just exactly the time when they don't need them. Container ships are kind of like hotels. And if they're not filled, they're not making money. And if they're not making money, then the price comes down. So that benefits consumers. You know, we're gonna see and companies like Walmart and IKEA that use a lot of shipping services. You know, they're gonna see their rates come down and probably stay down, as our Bloomberg Intelligence logistics analyst said. We're gonna see low ocean freight rates well into 2024.
Is it time to talk about the names again? Because
you can talk about the names again.
Why not talk about the names again? Brendan, I'm curious, since you did some dogged reporting here, what did you learn about names that was, you know, as somebody who follows this stuff so closely, you know, what was the big reveal for you in the naming of how we get these, you know, vessels that sometimes become iconic in pop culture in the case of, like, say, the Ever Given?
Right. So if you bring up the Ever Given, so Evergreen Marine is a Taiwanese company, and they like consistency. They like putting Ever in front of the name of their ship. So they've got dozens and dozens of ships. That's the Ever Burley, I think there was one, the Ever
Superb.
Just any noun, you know, fill in the blank and put Ever in front of it. And that's how they name their ships. Other companies that, you know, it's some source of corporate pride. I mean, the MSC said that they named theirs after family members of employees. So maybe it's a, you know, kind of a motivational thing. You know, you have a good year and, you know, you get a ship named after your kid or something.
Well, Brendan, I mean, you've done so much reporting on this. Have any companies come to you and said, we want to name this one after the trade czar at Bloomberg?
Well, you know, I did lobby for that with Maersk, and the public relations guy who I talked to said, you got to get in line behind me because I won't say his name, but he's, you know, kind of quietly wants one named after him.
The reason I say the Ever Brendan has a kind of nice ring to it.
It does. Don't get stuck in the Suez, though.
I agree. Exactly. Well, there's 900 ships coming over the next 3 or 4 years. And so, you know, you got to figure one of those, you know, could be named after one of us, maybe.
We didn't come back to Mayview, Missouri. Why Mayview again?
So Mayview stuck out to me because because I'm from St. Louis. And I wanted to know, how did this tiny little town, literally, like I said, there aren't any stoplights. It's not even a suburb of Kansas City. It's kind of just an old farming community that has basically had 200 or 300 residents for as long as I could see the census data go back. And it meant something to the history of the company. I spoke to the historian, Maersk has an in-house historian, and he said family members, you know, descendants of the founder who still work for the company. And that's just been the tradition that they try to, keep that tradition going.
Arnold Peter Moeller was married in Mayview. Go ahead. Go figure.
Ever Murray works too.
Ever Murray. It does. Ever Weber?
I mean, why not? I'll take that.
All right, Joel and Brendan. Stuck in the canal. Thank you.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
It is time for Plugged In, your weekly look at EVs. And I got to say, Tim, lots happening in the world always when it comes to electric vehicles. GM investing $650 million in developing the largest U.S. lithium deposit. And that's really a move to ramp up its efforts to secure supplies of the key metal used in electric vehicle batteries. I mean, it is all about getting those raw materials and components in order to be able to meet demand.
And speaking of demand and EVs, GM CEO Mary Barra dismissing concerns about those price cuts after Tesla and Ford cut their EV sticker prices. Look at shares of GM today, up significantly after reporting results. Let's break it all down with Bloomberg Technology co-host Ed Ludlow, who's in the Bloomberg 960 studio in San Francisco. Ed, I want to start with the $650 million investment that GM is going to make, the largest U.S. lithium deposit.
So yeah, it's a big headline.
It is. It is a big headline. But take us into the details of this.
Is it just a headline? Is that what you're saying?
What's the story behind the story here?
I mean, the devil's in the detail. This is for lithium supply starting from 2026, so a few years away from now. But, you know, it's all part of the wider story about concern for all of these players, Tesla being the pure play market incumbent, GM and Ford being the legacy US names transitioning to EV, making sure that they have access in their supply chains to the raw materials for battery cells, right? As they ramp up the volume of EVs they produce, they need more battery cells, and therefore they need more access to the metals that go into them. And it, you know, in this case, it's lithium. It's a partnership with Lithium Americas Corp. It's about a mine in Nevada, specifically the Thacker Pass mine. And you know, I think that, you know, it meets GM's ambition, right? Because this is a company that, you know, is aiming to build a million EVs a year eventually, and they need to make sure they've got the raw materials to do that.
Do we have enough lithium to do what we need to do to turn over everybody to an
EV? Trick question. That is a trick question.
I'm curious what the conversations you have around this.
Well, do you know why it's a trick question? And it's because it's not about necessarily how much lithium we have available to us, but also where it's coming from. Because remember, the whole point of the Inflation Reduction Act, which provides for a federal credit, a consumer incentive, being eligible for that incentive long term is dependent on where you source your raw materials on. In lithium's case in particular, China is such a massive player. And the whole point of the IRA is to make America's supply chain more competitive. So it's not just about how much lithium there is on the planet, it's about where it's coming from and making the US more competitive. And again, this announcement that GM made Tuesday is for a mine in Nevada. So that would very much mean that any battery packs with lithium from that mine were eligible going forward for that IRA credit.
But also brings us back to the question about making different batteries or batteries that have different materials in them, Ed. And are you betting on a component that's guaranteed to be used for the next X number of years?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at the work that Tesla's done, right, around changing the cell chemistry. Lithium is one metal that is prominent in lithium ion batteries, right? But also cobalt and nickel are important. You can use different cell compositions and cell chemistries to boost the proportion of one to the other. The end goal is to make sure that the battery or cell, and therefore pack, has the greatest energy density. How much energy can you squeeze into that little cylinder and into that battery pack? That is the equation from an economics perspective of what they're trying to achieve. How expensively or cheaply, conversely, you source your metals has a direct impact on that.
So I just feel like, you know, it's interesting, Ed. I was looking to put together some gainers for when we do our cross-platform, you know, market close here today.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you've got Tesla continuing, you know, to move higher this year, again, rallying. Rivian, I believe, was also among the top gainers in the NASDAQ 100. I just wanted to do a last check here. You know, we're seeing a lot of momentum into that space. We know that there's a bit of a pricing war going on, although GM's saying and Mary Barra saying we don't necessarily need to play in that price war. So what are the bigger, broader trends that are going on here when it comes to the EV space?
I mean, I would love to tell you that the market's dynamics driving the market is about kind of the love, back in love with EVs. You have to remember, these are also some of the most downtrodden stocks there are out there. Rivian and Lucid, the two worst performers on the NASDAQ 100 in 2022. Tesla had its worst year, I think on record, I was just checking my Bloomberg terminal, in 2022, right, a 65% decline. And so you see a lot of participants in the market look at how valuations have come down and say, yeah, now's a good time to buy. The other side of the coin is that Tesla's earnings were great. You know, they showed that using the lever of price cuts does induce demand. And Elon Musk talked about in the first early weeks of January of this year, the demand for their vehicles was twice what they're able to produce in that snapshot moment. So there is excitement about what's possible, but still nervousness broadly about demand tapering off this year.
Were you surprised, Ed, to hear GM CEO Mary Barra dismiss concerns about price cuts, given that Tesla and Ford seem to be in this, the beginnings of a price war?
Yes. I mean, the general consensus across sell side analysts, at least, was that Tesla cutting its prices, in the words of RBC, would have a cascading effect. So, you know, Ford went next. There was suspicion, actually, that we'll see the European automakers follow suit. GM's currently bucking that trend. It's interesting because they had earnings, right? And the numbers were very strong, particularly how bullish their outlook for earnings this year would be. The EBIT forecast in particular, or earnings per share of $6 to $7 for the full year. But you have to remember that that is held up on a pillar of sustained demand for their expensive gas vehicles while they transition to electric vehicles. The price cut comments were interesting, though. They basically seem to be saying, we're not going to adjust the prices of our electric vehicles for now. But remember, GM has done what many automakers do. First, come to market with a very expensive EV, and their models that are more mass market, more affordable, those are still a little way away from mass production. So that's part of the equation too.
Do we ever think about that in terms of the raw materials that we're going or that are needed in order to make all of these electric vehicles? I mean, I know the discussion's been out there, but Ed, I wonder if there's more momentum that we're just kind of trading a fixed commodity with limitations on the amount that are out there, meaning fossil fuels, just for another basket of raw materials that are fixed as well.
I appreciate the debate. I mean, at the end of the day, that fundamentally what you have is a lot of demand, which is in the form of many automakers with plans to ramp their output of electric vehicles, trying to latch on to what is a relatively finite, immediately available source of supply. You know, and it's no surprise that we saw GM make this announcement on lithium with Lithium Americas on Tuesday. Tesla's done very similar things in vertically integrating its supply chain, right? In other words, cut out the middleman, go direct to the source and use that to make your cells. The thing is that those legacy automakers, GM and Ford, they're future-proofing, right? So GM forecasts making 400,000 EVs from the start of last year through to the middle of next year. Long-term, their aim is to reach millions of units, but they're not quite there yet. Ford is ramping up the Marquee production from around 78,000 units last year to 130,000 this year. But long-term, its ambitions are much greater, and it's that long-term that they're trying to secure that supply for at the moment.
As we spoke about yesterday, though, Ed, one of the challenges here is the margins on EVs versus margins on internal combustion engine vehicles. I mean, look no further than GM's results for just how, you know, much bigger margins are when it comes to those old school gas guzzlers. Just in 30 seconds, because I want to talk about some other stuff here. Sure. What's to watch for with that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you build vehicles at greater volumes, you can buffer the margins. And if you cut prices, that's clearly a headwind to margins. And Ford are trying to get that equation right. The Marquee is unprofitable, but what they're saying is as we grow our footprint and produce greater volumes each year, there is some protection to margins that comes with that. I remember back in 2019, very quick, Jim Hackett, former CEO, the day they unveiled the Marquee, Idris Elba was there. It was weird. He promised it would be profitable from unit one, but then the world changed.
Right.
You know, inflation, rising commodities costs.
Okay, this is what I wanted to talk to you about. It's a hard pivot. It's Palantir Technologies. Tomorrow, you've got a big interview with Alex Karp.
Yeah.
He's the CEO and co-founder. 30 seconds. What's on your agenda?
Yeah, look, I'm getting a rare invite down to one of their facilities in Palo Alto. He's in town. Remember, this is a company that pivoted and moved from California to Colorado. And we're going to catch up, and you can catch the interview on Bloomberg Technology on Wednesday, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern.
That's a great interview. Looking forward to it, Ed, and really appreciate you weighing in, as you always do for us when it comes to the EV space, because it's kind of fast and furious sometimes. Ed Ludlow, co-host of Bloomberg Technology at Bloomberg News, really wide-ranging conversation. I do think about these raw materials and precious materials, if you will, and the access to them, and you know, it's kind of another race.
Yeah, and I think about a lot about how the technology has changed in just a few years.
For batteries?
For batteries,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business. Business app and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I turn on the radio. How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. Who's gonna drive you home? Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. Keep driving
crazy. It's the question that drives us. Keep driving
crazy. This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 17 minutes left in today's trading session. We've got, as you heard from Charlie, a rally underway. We've seen yields back off a bit. This less than 24 hours away from the first Fed decision of the new year. And coming up, we have a good guest to talk about what's going on in the trade here.
Yeah, very pleased to have with us this afternoon Larry Pitkowski, Managing Partner and Portfolio Manager at Goodhaven Capital Management, joining us on the phone from Millburn, New Jersey. Good to have you with us, Larry. So here we are at the end of the best January in years. We're seeing a rally just as the Fed kicks off its two-day policy meeting with the S&P 500 up by a full percentage point. Does the Fed rain on the parade tomorrow?
Tim, it's nice to be here. Hello, Carol. Tim, hi. I appreciate you starting with an easy question.
Okay.
And it's an easy question because I don't know. It is not the type of thing that we try and make short-term predictions about. And my I don't know is not a flippant or dismissive I don't know. It's a respectful and humble I don't know, because I do know, I believe, where at Goodhaven our circle of competence as investors ends. And we try very hard to develop a variant perception about the handful of companies we have an investment in, and we try and make those investments where we think we have margin of safety. But I don't think we have the ability to have a variant perception about short-term moves in Fed policy, interest rates, and the GDP. So we understand what everybody seems to be kind of expecting, a quarter of a point and the beginning of some slowdown in this. And we don't have a very different view. And again, we're not dismissive.
I guess for me, it's more about commentary and less about a singular move tomorrow. It's more about what Jay Powell says about holding rates higher for longer and what he says about financial conditions.
Our view about the recent environment is the following. I am not as young as I look or sound. I have seen periods where there have been existential risks to the financial system and to the economy. I've been saying for the last...
in other words, you understand that a zero interest rate environment is abnormal, normal.
Carol, you make a great point. And a few years ago, we did say, like, look, interest rates will go higher at some point. And we tried to add some things to the portfolio that we thought would benefit from somewhat higher rates. So some financial companies that could use more interest income, whether it be property and casualty insurance companies or some aspects of the commercial banking sector. But I don't think what we've been experiencing recently, which is much higher interest rates and a slower economy, is an existential economic risk compared to some things I have seen in my career. So we've been doing what we normally do. We get up earlier, go to sleep later, and keep looking for a handful of companies that we think can do fine even in an imperfect economy, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to find some.
Well, and I'm looking at your fund, the Goodhaven Fund, year to date up more than 7%, putting it in the 93rd percentile according to Bloomberg data. Longer term, 3 years on average, annually a gain of more than 11%, putting it in the 90th percentile. So you're making some good bets. A listener and viewer of Business Week writing in and saying, what went into the decision to invest more in larger cap stocks as opposed to small to mid cap stocks?
First of all, Carol, thank you for noticing. We have been working quite hard, to continue to drive long-term returns, like that for us and our fellow shareholders. So thank you.
You're welcome.
We have a mix of larger companies. Some of them are that are household names. We have a mix of some mid-sized companies, and we have some real below-the-radar screen companies. We are not, myself and also Artie Kwok here, who works with me, we are not waking up every day saying, boy, we want to look for another company of a certain size, or, you know, we're looking for the best bargains in companies we feel that we understand where they are going, we understand the management teams, we think we have an edge in understanding the business and where we're buying with a margin of safety that we can find. And, you know, one should find great things infrequently, but we've been fortunate to have been, I think, positioned reasonably well, as the statistics you called out have demonstrated.
What's been a new buy as of late? And well, not necessarily a whole new position or adding to a position.
Well, we had kept our eye on for some years KKR. Mm-hmm. In our mind, the movement of capital to the alternative asset managers over the last bunch of years was a very interesting trend, and it was not a trend we thought was stopping anytime soon. As a matter of fact, very recently, I think New York has upped the percentage that they're going to commit to alternatives from like 25% to 35%. We ended up first, we looked at KKR and we admired what they had built. Distributable earnings had gone from like $1.66 in 2017 to recently like $4.50 a share. That's $1.66 per share to $4.50 a share over the last trailing 12 months. Mm-hmm. And we bought some at the peak of the COVID in the spring of 2020, when, you know, the world was going through a very difficult period. But we have added to it in 2022, kind of around these prices. What I think has been interesting lately is some of the cloud from some of the issues surrounding, you know, the Blackstone BREIT, I think has given perhaps an opportunity to look at the whole sector. And KKR is the only one we own, and we think it's well managed. We think we understand where the business is going. Mm-hmm. We think earnings, management says they think earnings can be $7 within a couple of years, and we think that's intriguing.
Yeah, it rallied big time in 2020, 84% higher in 2021, down about 38% last year, but we're seeing money move into KKR. Certainly this year, it's already up almost 20% here in 2023. Larry Pitkowski, thank you so much. Managing Partner, Portfolio Manager at Goodhaven Capital Management, joining us on the phone from Millburn, New Jersey.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.